Capital Region, this is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the ancestral and unceded homelands of the Mohican people, now known as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. I'm Andrea Cunliffe. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we bring you a special selection of segments focusing on the Capital Region's community arts project that were developed and produced during 2021. We begin with Common Unity Banners Block Party in Schenectady in August. Then we revisit the annual exhibition of Mission Accomplished Transition Services Fashion Showcase. Later on, Benjamin Sheraton and Grace Lee Lawrence of the new collaborative studio, Eight Plums, speak of their window art installation in Albany. After that, artist Meg Jala of the art project The Fish Market in North Central Troy, finally founder and artistic director of the Black Theater Troupe of upstate New York, Jean-Remy Monet, talks about addressing social justice issues through performance and theater. Art has a great ability to engage and unify communities. In this segment, we cover the Common Unity Banners Block Party in Schenectady, celebrating using artists and community youths to build an artistic and social corridor from the underpass of Craig in Maine. Hi, this is Andrea Cunliffe with Hudson Mohawk Magazine. On Tuesday, August 31st, from 4 o'clock till 7 p.m. on the Craig Main Bridge in Schenectady, New York, we are all invited to the Common Unity Block Party. With us today is one of the organizers.
Yes, my name is William Rivas. I am the founder of Save Our Streets. I'm also the CEO and executive director of Cocoa House and the owner and CEO of Common Unity LLC, which is a consulting and development agency. So what the Common Unity Banners Project exactly is it came from the Schenectady Thriving Neighborhoods Challenge, which is under the Schenectady Foundation. And those projects are specifically for neighborhood individuals to come to the forefront with ideas and projects that they would like to see to not only beautify, but just to make their neighborhoods better. The Craig Main Connection is actually a separate project. I believe it's a $4 million project that's going to be coming into the city of Schenectady, tying in the neighborhood through Albany Streets, Craig in the main area. What I wanted to do with this project as an individual who's grown up in the neighborhood, it's always my pride and joy to be able to work with like-minded organizations and individuals. And those people who are part of the team are Mary Moore Wallinger, which is the owner and CEO of Land Art Studio, Johan Matthews, who's the owner of A Mutual Design Co., and Heather Hutchison, which is the executive director of Create Studios. Came up with this project, listening to the voice of the youth specifically in the community. And this project is really phenomenal in the fact that it ties together the history of the nonprofit organizations that have operated in Hamilton Hill. Those organizations are Community Fathers, Save Our Streets, Cocoa House, Hamilton Arts Center, Boys and Girls Club, 518 Boys Day Out, Electric City Barn, the Boys and Girls Club, I believe I said, and Working Group on Girls. And these organizations, they have been just monumental in serving the most underprivileged youth who live in the city of Schenectady for over 20 plus years. So what I wanted to do was, I thought it was important for a project such as the Craig Main Connection to have a point that really started with the community. And I say that because what happens is a lot of times these opportunities come into our communities and it seems and it feels like gentrification. And from the very first meeting, I actually went to the first meeting of the Craig Main Connection and I told them that's what I felt like it was. And I was blessed by Mary Moore Wallinger to have an opportunity to be a part of the team that brought the message of what the Craig Main Connection was to the community and to assist and make sure that the community's voice was not only heard, but was a part of the actual essence, the overall vibrance of these projects.
So it's an area that's Vail, Hamilton Hill, and Mount Pleasant, three communities that are together, and driving right through it is 890, an expressway. Well, we all know how depressing underpasses can be. It segregates communities. It separates them. It creates a barrier. It's like some kind of wall, emotional, social, political wall that has a way of bringing agitation, perhaps.
Yes.
Or not giving a people a feeling of community with one another. So this is like a social movement art yes. project, isn't it?
Yeah, and the reason why that's important is because as a youth, I used to walk that bridge. I lived with my grandfather right on 877 Strong Street, was at the top of the hill of that bridge. And living in that community, there's a lot of poverty, violence, gangs, drugs. And the thing is exactly what you said is truth. That bridge separates two communities, but the two communities live with almost the same exact circumstances. Mount Pleasant on one side, Hamilton Hill on all the other. And the thing is growing up with that bridge as a kid, you weren't supposed to cross that bridge because if you did, you were going into dangerous territory. And the thing is as an adult who works in the field, I start to really understand how small things like this can cause really big traumatic experiences. So what I try to do, and what's very interesting is even down to the name of the project, there is intent behind a social emotional movement, and that is common unity. When most people see that, they're like, no, community. And I said, no, specifically, I researched the root word community, and I broke it down to its essence, which is common unity. Community is a group of people based on where we're looking at now. It's based on more or less location and socioeconomic status. If you go into more wealthy neighborhoods, they're not called communities, they're called neighborhoods. Community is usually dictated specifically only for communities like ours that are living in poverty. So to empower myself and the individuals that I work with, what I did was I took the word and broke it down from community to common unity. The common ties that bind life, love, family, the truest form of change in essence is to eliminate all barriers and just focus on people. If there was no money, we would all still need the same exact thing. So even down to the very beginning, to the name that is the Common Unity Banner Project, there's intent.
It's amazing that it takes art to break that down. It takes creativity, imagination, art to break down the barrier there, and you're making something positive of it.
Right. And that was really the goal, which is why, Heather, Marie Moore, and Johan have just been excellent, is, again, in bringing different organizations together for a project like this, there's no room for egos or in the room or agendas. It's really all about a common goal of bringing the message of the people to these projects and giving the people ownership of the projects that are going to be coming down the pipeline for their communities. I didn't want our community to look different in 20 years and for our people not to have a say in what it looked like, because we see that happens in so many communities of poverty. Change happens, property values drop, and gentrification happens, and before you know it, all the houses and there's new jobs and there's all these things, and the people who originally lived and grew up in those neighborhoods no longer exist. Their history is almost wiped away from the books. So what we wanted to do, and again, this was being strategic from the very beginning, is we wanted to create something that is going to last and speaks to the nature of the people, the organizations, community organizations, the artists, community artists. The artwork was done by community youth. So each and every piece of this project was very specific in how we detailed it and what our intent was.
So tell me now more a little bit about what happens tomorrow. Tomorrow between 4 and 7. Sounds like quite a nice party, actually.
Yes. So tomorrow what we're going to be doing from 4 to 7 is we're going to be having a block party, an unveiling party, the first of its kind, actually on the bridge with the organizations. They're going to be present to pass out flyers. Everything is free. Food is free. Drinks are free. There's some other snacks and there's some free ice cream that'll be there as well. We have some very important people coming to speak and to just show recognition to the work that's been done, to acknowledge our community youth, to acknowledge our community artists, and to acknowledge our community programs. And really, it's all about setting a tone moving forward. This is the first piece of the Craig Main Connection project. So this piece is the cornerstone of how we're going to expect our community to operate over the next 20, 30 years when it comes to projects of this kind. Tomorrow is really, we have DJ Ketchup who's going to be bringing the music. We're raffling off some free flat screen TVs, maybe also some iPads. But again, the beautiful thing about this is everything is sponsored and paid for. Everything is absolutely free. And for the first 500 youth that show up tomorrow, they're going to be receiving a backpack full of school supplies and goodies.
That's pretty terrific. Where exactly is this happening? Underneath the underpass or not on the bridge itself?
On the bridge.
On the bridge?
Yes, ma'am.
Is the bridge closed?
No, yes, the whole bridge is closed. Yes, now you see why I'm so excited.
I guess so. They're closing the bridge for this party?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. This is a big deal. Oh, it sounds wonderful.
Yes, we actually got permission to shut the whole bridge down for 4 hours for this block party, for this project. And that's why it's so important for people to come out and take part tomorrow, because the things that were able to happen is community-led, community-driven, community-oriented.
How can we find out more about it?
Yeah, if they go online to the Schenectady Foundation Thriving Neighborhoods Challenge, you'll see that there is a link leading to our project. And also, if you look up the Craig Main Connection on their website, we have our own link on the website as well that details the entire project, all the artists, all the organizations, all the information part, the information about the banners. And you can literally see exactly how this project is setting off a much larger trend over the next 20 years. So in 20 years, we'll sit here and we'll have this conversation about this project and how it changed the face of our community.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Current information about the Craig Main Connection in Schenectady can be found at www.craigmainconnection.com. Albany-based Mission Accomplished Transition Services helps to develop professional businesses for emerging entrepreneurs and artists. In August, they produced Fashion Showcase, Fashion Edition Institute's annual exhibition of their work they produced through their program. I spoke with Coach Carmen about their developing organization.
Andrea Cunliffe here with Hudson Mohawk Magazine, speaking with Coach Carmen. Mission Accomplished Transition Services has a special event coming up. Hello and welcome, Coach Carmen.
Thank you so very much for having me. We are a career education organization that provides mentorship, coaching, and sponsorship for emerging young professionals and entrepreneurs aged 13 to 35 who are pursuing or seeking to advance a career or scale a business in fashion, construction, interior design, or as an artist. Specifically, and we also focus on social entrepreneurship. So majority of our students are very much committed to making an impact within their communities from a social justice lens, whether they are an entrepreneur or working at a business.
Yeah. Are you one of the original developers of this concept, Mission Accomplished?
I am the founder. And of course, I had a group of founding board members who assisted with the launch of the business in 2012.
People who are out trying to start a business or want to form a career path, you guide them, mm-hmm. you mentor them, you encourage them. Do you also mix people together that would benefit one another, like an entrepreneur or focused in business would be? It seems to me that in your fashion showcase, you've mixed creative people with those with practical skills of let's say marketing or accounting or some kind of foundation to help build a business.
Yes, we do. Our students are paired with established subject matter experts in the particular industry that they are pursuing a career or seeking to scale a business. This is truly an opportunity for us to help the students with developing a network of industry professionals who truly have a passion for mentorship and helping the next generation of individuals with gaining access to opportunities and resources. So it's not as hard as it may have been for them seeking to establish a business.
So who are the mentors?
We make sure that we're connecting students with industry experts who can really give them insight to what it means puts you ahead of other individuals is when you truly understand the business behind an industry.
Yeah, I notice that in the arts a lot. A lot of us are just educated in their craft and not learned how to keep money and earning a living. So it's great. So how do you choose those students or participants and what you're going to be focused on?
For our high school-based program and our community-based program, our high school-based program is specifically for high school students, and our community-based program is specifically for individuals between the ages of 18 to 35 who have 2+ years experience in the industry, whether that be fashion or it be construction and design. We put an application out to the public, and then they complete the application. We interview the students, and then we select the students who really show that they're ready for coaching and mentorship and honest feedback and guidance. And you can see that if they get that guidance and support, they will take themselves to the next level. Of course, with our high school students, it's more from an exploring standpoint, where it's, you know, social entrepreneurship is an opportunity for you. Construction is an opportunity for you. So let's connect you with these individuals who are already in the industry and can educate you about the various career paths that you can pursue post high school or while in high school. And then with our community-based program is 100% about helping people advance to the next level. So the people that are coming in through our community-based programs are really ready to go to the next level, but they really don't know how to get there. They know where they want to be, but they don't know how to bridge the gap or build the bridge to bridge the gap to get to where it is that they want to be. But our students self-select by going through an application and enrollment process.
You've got something coming up this weekend, I believe, on Saturday the 7th.
Absolutely. So the Fashion Showcase, this is our 5th showcase that we've had. The focus is to highlight the fashion professionals who have completed our intensive career and business development program named the Fashion Edition Institute. And the goal of this event is to highlight their talents, their skills, and their businesses, and the fact that they are looking to continue paving the path forward within the fashion industry, particularly here in the Capital Region, while also creating a space for emerging and established fashion professionals to network with one another. So priority is to highlight the students who are completing the Fashion Edition Institute. Second, the focus is to make sure that local fashion professionals are able to connect with one another. And this event will take place this Saturday from 5:30 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. at Crossgates Mall in the former New York and Company retail store. From 5:30 to 7 will be the vendor fair, so certainly come and shop with the students or the fashion professionals. And then from 7 to 9:30, we will showcase them. They will present on the companies that they have developed and share with the audience where they are looking to go next. But individuals do need to register or RSVP in order to gain access to the event.
What would this event be? Will we see fashion? Are they forming an organization or a company together, or pursuing independent careers?
They are forming independent businesses. So each one of these 6 talented fashion professionals have their own businesses, whether it is an event production company or a apparel.
Will we see some of the design?
Yep, during the vendor fair from 5 to 7, individuals will be able to shop with the students. They will see their designs. Please remember, this is not just about apparel designers. We have event producers. We have a hairstylist. It's really focused on fashion professionals and not just apparel designers. most times when people hear fashion, the first thing they think about is someone who designs clothes. But there's much more that's connected to the fashion industry.
I think it's an important concept for presenting emerging professionals. How does this fund itself?
The Fashion Edition Institute and the Fashion Showcase is made possible by the support of a host of sponsors, including KeyBank, Ungerman Electric, Corey Jameson Consulting, and DIY Marriage Retreat, as well as the investment of time of some of the mentors that participate. And it wouldn't be possible without their support. And CrossGates is 100% one of our community partners to make sure that we're able to produce this event in an environment of fashion.
The Fashion Showcase is one of your many projects. What do you have coming up in the future?
We will have some programs that will launch in the fall, and that will be our construction and design program. And then in the spring, the Fashion Edition Institute will come back around.
Construction with design, does that include architecture and construction?
Construction, interior design, and visual artistry, specifically murals.
You're actually physically located where, in Schenectady?
Yes.
So during COVID times, how have you been able to deal with it? And I'm afraid we may be masking up again. What are your future plans?
We just keep going, you know, as much as we are able to. We pivot when we need to. If we can no longer meet in person, we bring it online to Zoom, as so many people have done. And we just keep it going as much as we are able to.
Thanks so much for your time. I look forward to Saturday, at August 7th, between 5:30 and 9:30, to meet with you, Coach Carmen, from Mission Accomplished Transition Services.
Mission Accomplished Transition Services website, mantransitionservices.org. And for those of you just tuning in, I'm Andrea Cunliffe. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany. This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the ancestral and unceded homelands of the Mohican people, now known as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. As part of Albany Public Library's new initiative, Creative Curbsides, creating bright, colorful art installations, Grace Lee Lawrence and Ben Saraton are in conversation about their window installation at the Bach Library in Albany.
It's Andrea Cunliffe here with Hudson Mohawk Magazine, and I'm talking with Grace Lee Lawrence and Benjamin Saraton, who are two artists. You're here in Troy.
Eight Plums is the name we gave our new collaborative practice. We decided to start making work together. I'm a musician by trade. Grace is a sculptor. And we wanted to kind of find where we could interact in those two fields. And our first exhibition is coming up starting this Friday.
Yeah, it will be at the Bach Branch Library in Albany. And this was a project through Opalka Gallery at the Sage Colleges. And so they were trying to do a public work that would allow people to experience an art installation in the windows of the library. So something that didn't necessitate people going inside. And so as recent transplants to the area, we have spent a lot of time looking at all of the beautiful waterways and thinking about the ways that water has shaped this landscape. And we decided to focus on these abstracted water-like forms that reminded us of the way that the rivers run and hydroelectric power and electricity and also the kind of natural forces that are at work in this area. And we're using a really specific kind of material. Ben can talk about that.
Yeah, all these wiggly, watery shapes, we're cutting them out into a material called dichroic film that will cling to the windows. The library where this is being installed has this wonderful curved bank of windows. and we're going to apply this film, and it changes color. It almost looks like a hologram, but it projects colored light, and it can be anywhere between gold and pink and blue. And it's just a really colorful, really vibrant thing. We're hoping we can make going to the library that much more colorful.
It's such a good idea in the COVID times to have some place to be able to visually see art and feel art.
The Arbor Hill branch also has another artist or set of artists who are doing window displays. We actually haven't been told who they are. We don't know anything about what's happening there, but people can also expect to see some installation work at Arbor Hill.
You're a musician, Ben. Are you applying music to the sculpture?
Not so much in this particular application. It's something that is important to our work. I will say we are listening to music at very loud volumes while we fabricate the large-scale installation, and it does feel like an important part of the work.
Yeah, and also during the process of making this piece, we actually put in an application for a future project that could potentially be realized that is more of a combination of my sculptural ability and Ben's musical proclivity, and also the intersection of those two things. So we're both, especially now, thinking a lot about digital space and kind of digital overload and what that means. And so that project is going more in that direction using these really specific skill sets. But this project is very much both of our interpretations of the prompt and a kind of the first collision of our processes together in a way that I think neither one of us would have necessarily engaged with otherwise.
It's true.
Yeah.
You've worked in art before, no, Ben?
I have a little bit of a professional art background. I've worked in the art world. I worked at a private art foundation for the last 3 years. So I have some experience, and I'm a big fan of art.
You have a kind of burgeoning visual practice that you're working on. I mean, it's really for you primarily, but that's a language that you're learning. But the way that we designed this particular project, we talked a lot about it. Ben is a really amazing writer, and so he kind of processed all of our thinking into the written language around the project. And then I did the rendering in the digital design program that I use. And we talked about how we wanted it to feel and the shapes we wanted to use, and then kind of cross edited. So we talked through the writing and edited that down. And then we talked through the images that I made and edited that down. So we're taking our particular skill sets and then colliding them and kind of seeing what falls out of that.
Is this the first major project you've done together? Have you done other projects together?
Officially, yes. Yeah. I've contributed some efforts to Grace Lee's practice. I've done some 3D scanning. Mm-hmm. Her work involves a lot of digital fabrication and digital imagery.
You move a lot of objects.
I've moved a lot of sculptures. So we're very involved in each other's work.
I've made merch for you. Mm-hmm. I've made kind of accompanying objects that go with his album releases and things like that. But both of those things are very much like in service of our own personal practices. And so this is the first time that we're actually collaborating on something that is really authored by both of us. And so that was sort of the entryway to our collaborative work.
Did you find this project and then adapted your idea to fit the project?
I think it was more that we saw the proposal and, a great component of this is that we're not showing in the traditional gallery. This isn't a public library. Mm-hmm. That's being utilized and beloved by the community. And we're huge fans of the library. Like I said, we live across the street from the public library in Troy.
Yeah, that's an important kind of way that we associate ourselves in the world is across from the public library in Troy.
And we use it every single day. I mean, we have been tearing through the shelves and the stacks at the Troy Public Library since we've moved. It's a wonderful resource. I'm a lifelong library fan. So when the opportunity to do something to make a library even more wonderful popped up, we were really excited by that.
Yeah.
And approached it from the perspective of what would we want to see if we were taking books out of this particular branch of the library.
Which maybe I didn't mention earlier, was that they're wanting to attract people to come to the curbside pickup. You know, they want to make something that makes people interested so that they come and utilize the resources of the library, even if they can't come inside.
This is certainly more performative than a white wall gallery. I think it is an interruption of a normal kind of pedestrian everyday experience.
Yeah, it's site specific. You know, we've made something that's really particular for this branch of the library. You know, it fits these windows in a particular way. We've spent time there kind of determining how the material will interact with the space. So I would very much consider it a site-specific installation that has to be experienced in person because of the way that the color refracts.
How is this installed in the library? Are they plastic pieces that are...
Oh.
brought in?
It's a static cling, so we're gonna just squeegee them on. I mean, it's just adhered with water.
Yeah.
God, and so, just to think you're in Troy, where stained glass really grew and was prolific.
That's a great connection.
You guys are doing the same thing, only today.
Yeah. Temporarily.
Yeah, the temporary.
Well, Grace Lee and Benjamin, do you have anything you want to tell us that I've missed before we end this interview?
Well, I put out a record earlier this year called Youth Pastoral. It came out in February, kind of right before everything shut down.
Directly right before.
And if people want to check that out. It's very different than the work we're installing at the library, but mm-hmm. if you like songs and guitar playing kind of like Neil Young, you might want to check it out. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I checked out your website, which I think everyone should check out because it's really interesting. Your work, Grace Lee, is enormous.
Yes.
You do huge pieces of work. And I was shocked because I didn't think there were that many women who did really big pieces of sculpture.
Well, probably
what brought you to
not
that?
Not very many people who do it on their own. I do the majority of the fabrication myself on my own in my studio. Ben is an exception that he'll come and help me move things that I can't move by myself. But generally speaking, it's really important that I'm doing the labor and that the action of my body performing the labor on these really big objects is a part of the purpose. And a lot of that does have to do with kind of the expectations of scale and monumental scale and what it means to be a sculptor. And so the process and the scale and the fabrication and the way that it's fabricated using digital fabrication is all wrapped up in the meaning of the work for me. So all of my work is made using digital fabrication, either CNC routed foam or 3D printed plastic that's then coated in fiberglass and epoxy putty and resins. And so it's kind of like a boat building process that I apply to the objects, which is much more accessible for me to make rather than big casted forms, which would certainly need a whole team to do. So
you've been doing a lot of auto painting lately too.
Yeah. And so some of the finishes almost look metallic because of the way that they're painted, and they're generally auto coat paint. So they have pearl pigments or other specialty pigments, and then they give them that little bit of a sheen.
Thank you, Grace Lee Lawrence and Benjamin Sarriton, for spending a few minutes with us and letting us know there's something great to do this winter.
The installation will be up from December 18th, 19th. Until March, and maybe beyond.
Benjamin Sarriton and Grace Lee Lawrence recently relocated to Troy in the new collaborative studio, Eight Plums, which combines the sculpture with words and music. The fish market in north central Troy was repurposed into a community-driven artist in residency. Hudson Mohawk Magazine's Sina Basilahicki went to visit Meg Jala, the current artist in residence. Meg spoke about the need for communities to have access to art as a means of connection, exploration, healing, and self-expression.
Hi, my name is Meg Jala. I am an artist in residence at the Fish Market in Troy, New York. The Fish Market is a community engagement project that is run by the Arts Center of the Capital Region. It is a social practice artistic residency, which is centered around engaging the community and seeing what they want and need. And also, as an artist, like having the space to create your art, but with that in mind. So they used to sell fish here, kind of like they do in New York City, like where you can go in, get some fresh fish, they fry it for you, they cook it for you. It was abandoned. The owner took it and renovated it. It looks like a fish market from the outside. Like, it still has the sign Empire Fish Market, but when you go in, you see all of the art. It's centered in North Central Troy, so it's across the street from Star Grocery. There's some apartments around the corner from a beautiful park where the kids play basketball, right up the street from Troy Prep. It's a really nice neighborhood, really nice community. Now we're on the inside of the fish market. So when you come in, you enter first and you see a ritual space. In my artwork, it's very important to me that I include ritual. So when you're coming in, whether into a space or to a workshop or to a show, whatever it is that I'm doing, you have a space where you can stop and reflect and take the weight from the day off. And then as you come in, you see our art book collection. There are bright and vibrant dance paintings. We have a beautiful exposed brick wall. You can see my art all over the floor. Depending on when you come in, we have space for you to relax.
What makes you the ideal person for this space? And in the larger question, what is the role of the artist residency here in this neighborhood?
I would like to be flexible with the word ideal. Like, I think for me, I'm very chatty. I love people. I love to talk with people about their creativity. I love to offer people space where they can explore what they want, what they need, what their impulses are. In this particular space, we are trying to gauge what the immediate community wants and needs. So that requires a lot of conversations. It requires being open and talking to people, inviting people in, and having just space where people can come in and be themselves. And in terms of like the background of that, like myself as an artist, I go back to like the roots of all of our ancestors and the traditions that before, people would just naturally, in community, do things together. They would sing, they would dance, they would make art, they would gather food, they would cook together, they would tell stories. And it wasn't just one or two people doing this. It wasn't inaccessible. It was accessible to everyone. It was just a part of everyday life. And that was the way that they would take the weight off of their day. They would still, even after a long day, participate in this community aspect. And that's how they found support, and that's how they found healing. And essentially, that's the idea of the space here. When we talk about community engagement, we're talking about not coming into a space and saying, this is what we want you to have. More so, here are some opportunities. Let's talk to you and see what it is that you want and you need for your community space. So what I'm finding is that as you encourage creativity in a whole community spectrum, specifically in adults, that trickles down to children, and it becomes a natural thing that everybody participates in. It's not a thing that's, oh, this is what I did before, but more so encouraging that that can be a lifelong practice, and it doesn't have to be a thing that you capitalize off of. It can just be a thing that you do and enjoy. So for open hours, typically, we just had a speakeasy in here, a large event. Typically, I have a table set up with a few different supplies on it. Start back here. But I have like lots of different arts and crafts. Paint, I have colored pencils, I have markers, I have collage stuff, I have canvases, I have paper, I have all kinds of different things that I set out, and I just let them choose what they want to do and explore it. And if they have questions about things, like they're particularly interested, the smaller children, in my dance paintings, they want to do it. So I told a couple of them, if they ask their parents, and they come in like old clothes, and their parents are ready to receive them covered in paint, then they can do that as well. So I try to maintain an open space where like people can just come up to me with an idea, and I help them bring it to fruition. Typically with my dance paintings, I do large-scale paintings on raw canvas or sometimes stretch canvas, sometimes other mediums. And I pick a theme, or it's a theme based off of something that I'm writing, and I create a playlist based off of that theme. And then I pick my colors, and I dance on the canvas, and I use the paint, typically acrylic paint, and I put the paint intuitively on the canvas, and then I dance and I move and I add more paint as I need to, and I keep going until I feel that it's finished. And then sometimes I'll finish that off with letting it dry and then adding another layer with dancing, or I'll do like a free flow sort of abstract expression, throwing like the paint or like pouring the paint. And the kids think that's really cool. At first they thought it was weird though. They were like, this is really weird, Miss Meg. And then they were like, no, this is really cool. I see sadness. I see anger. I see, this makes me feel really good. It makes me feel really happy and I want to do it. So like, I'll leave them out. And if they're dry, they like to roll on them and like play on them, and it's not off limits. They can access it.
It's been 4 months. Can you talk a little bit more of the evolution from the reception from the community, but also kids and adults' evolution in their idea of what is weird, as you just said, and what is really, really cool? And does that have to do with the fact that they've bonded with you and suddenly something that they didn't understand because they didn't have a connection to it, now they see you, really respect you, and therefore they see your art in a different way?
Well, I feel like the evolution kind of started with me standing outside and talking to neighbors because they saw me moving, and people would come up to me and say, hey, what do you got going on here? How can we help you? What can we do? And it really was a lot of street conversation, like walking around the neighborhood and like people coming in thinking it was a like an actual fish market where I sold fish. And I started out with like nothing in the space, and I installed my show Body. I was going to install 3 or 4 separate shows for the duration of my residency. But then I realized that the idea of the residency is just to let myself make art. And I think through allowing myself to make art, that's what's drawn people more to me. It's not that I wasn't making art before. It was more so that I was making the art and then keeping it hidden until it was time to debut it, which is what we typically do as artists, right? But as a residency, being in the community is something that you want to share. Like the whole process, like then becomes like this open concept of like, oh, I'm supposed to be sharing the whole thing. And that's what makes people interested. And at first, sometimes, like, I'll be doing the dance paintings and people will be looking in the window, wondering what's going on. And then sometimes those same people will stop by later and they'll see it and they'll be like, oh, this is really cool. And I feel like the evolution with the children has been more so like, they know I'm here. They know they can come in. They know they can hang out. They know they have a place to go. I still have a lot more people to meet, but I find that the people that I do meet come back. I don't really know what's going to happen. I just see that it's becoming more open, and as time goes by, people are more comfortable coming to me, or even if not me, they're comfortable asking their neighbor, hey, what is she doing in there? And the neighbor will say, oh, that's an art space. So it's becoming like more of like a word of mouth kind of thing. And I love that. And I hope it continues to expand and grow. And I think that it will.
You can learn more about this project at the Arts Center of the Capital Region. So this year, Jean-Remy Monet found a new home for the Black Theater Troupe of upstate New York at the newly reopened Cap Rep. We bring you a discussion he had earlier this year with Hudson Mohawk Magazine's Lizzie Kramer. Here he speaks about how his troupe addresses issues of social. He speaks here about how his troupe addresses issues of social justice in our society, both within the plays they choose to perform and how the performance itself is crafted.
My name is Lizzie Kramer, and I'm here with Jean-Remy Monet, the director of the Black Theater Troupe of upstate New York, to talk about how performance can be used to comment on issues of social justice.
My name is Remy, Jean-Remy Monet. What I do right now, I'm the founder and the artistic director of the Black Theater Troupe of Upstate New York. I'm originally from Haiti. I moved up here in 1982. I live in New York City, and I worked for 30 years for the state, and then I retired back in 2018. But the whole time that I've been performing acting since I was like 9 years old, you know, in Haiti, in French and Creole. And then, but I had to stop when I came up here because I didn't really speak the language. So I was performing locally with some Haitian troops and stuff. I said, you know what? I can't stop living my, you know, my life, my passion, just because of some stupid language. So I decided I need to focus on my life. I got a transfer. I was still working for the state in 97. I moved up here in the capital region. And then I still wasn't doing theater until 1999. And then I decided to go back to school for performing arts. And I started acting my first play in English. I was one of probably three black actors in the area. So I decided I gotta do something about that. 2009, a friend of mine decided to start a theater company to promote diversity. And then we did, but it was dissolved. And in 2010, I thought, this is a good dream, helping. I can't let that go like that. So I decided to restart the company. And then we've been around since 2011, being small events, working with the community and talking to kids, adults, all ages in the community. I decided to do this full time and then start doing more shows. And then 2020 happened and then everything stopped. We took a break, but we're still doing virtual work. People, you know, are getting calls from family. They want their kids to be involved. They want to be involved. I'm getting, you know, playwright from, you know, all over the state. Even England is sending me their script because they know we're a black theater troupe from all race, black or white or Hispanic playwright. But the story has to be about black lives, about our history, our struggle, and I've done probably, you know, over 200 plays in English and small part, and the main role, all kind of stuff. Since we started the theater company, we put a lot of people out there, kids, all age of, you know, people of color, not just black. We're also very diverse. We may be the black theater troupe. And I think I saw on Facebook, somebody posted that the black theater troupe is more inclusive, more diverse than even the regular theater company. Think about that, okay? I've been doing a lot. You know, working with the community, you know, working with all the theater companies, you know, a lot of great things happening, and those are things that I pray God for. Now I can help people more. You know, a lot of people helped me to get here, and I've been helping people and trying to make the stage more, what I like to call it, more colorful.
Who are the communities who end up being in your play, or how do you find the people?
Well, you know, for 12 years, it was my job because, as you know, the theater company was trying to bring more people of color. The stage was too white. It's been too white, you know, all along because nobody was making the efforts to go after them. They didn't even try. There was a couple of black plays, but mostly they weren't really doing, a lot of plays weren't doing anything to be more inclusive. So when I started this theater company, I go out there, I work with people. You don't have to have experience. And we mostly a black theater company, but we work with everybody. We just reverse everything. The majority, the main characters are black, and we work with kids. So, and all the plays we do, those are plays to educate people. It has meaning. If it's a comedy, there's a message there. Where we've come from, you know, from slavery to racism to all the stuff they tell people. And even if somebody called me to direct a show, they know the kind of show that I like. We mostly reach out to everybody, but mostly the black community. And we do also at the same time, that's how, you know, we do a lot of things about social injustice and stuff like that. A lot of people go out to protest, you know, like Black Lives Matter here, they protest, you know, racism, they protest about police brutality. Different people protest different way. The way I protest, I find a play that deal with those kind of things, and I put it on stage, whether through my own voice or through somebody else's voice, and then people come and see it, and I educate people that way. That's how I protest, and it's very effective because my audience is all races. When you come, you may get offended. We're not offending anybody, it's not offending, I'm saying, but you may be uncomfortable, I guess that's what I'm saying, which is good because, you know, you're learning some things been going on for 400 years, how, whether it's you, but it's your ancestors been treating people, you know, even with racism, and you learn something. It may be uncomfortable, but you learn, you educate it. You can live, you go home, and you can educate your partner, your mother, your sister about what's going on. If you don't come to see our plays, you know, because it's about racism, then and you don't want to come to learn, to be educated, then, you know, there's no hope for you.
I would love to hear a little bit more about the social justice initiatives that your company does.
Almost all our plays are about that. We do a lot of plays about racism, about police brutality, educating people. We've worked with the community about the prison systems. We work with PLS, Prisoners Legal Services, once a year. PLS work with the prison system throughout New York State, and then they work with incarcerated individuals. They ask them to write anything, and it could be about racism in prison, it could be about immigration, it could be about how they are treated, it could be about them. Those incarcerated individuals, they submitted written material to PLS, some about maybe 40, sometimes 200 pieces. And PLS selected 40 and they send them to me, and I get actors to perform those on stage. Also, I work with, you know, sometimes we put together pieces about social injustice, about police brutality, and I get actors, you know, actual actors who experience, you know, racism, and they perform that to educate people. I myself perform a lot of those pieces as a black man. And if I leave my house, I want to make sure my house is clean. I want to make sure the bed is done. Not only, you know, I like it to be that way, but I always want to make sure, just in case I don't come back home, if somebody come to my house, you know, everything is clean. By not coming back home, because as a black man, if I get pulled over by a cop, all kind of things go through my head. As a white man or woman, you don't go through all that. You don't have to worry about that. Okay, if I'm going to the doctor, I make sure that I dressed up, because, you know, I dress up, they treat me better if I just show up, you know, with a pair of shorts. You know, they call me bum. But if you're a white man, you show up with a shirt or a t-shirt, that's totally fine, but it's not for me. And it does work for me, because I show up well-dressed and not everybody friendly with me in the office. It's important, so, because I know the way it is, so I will write about that. I wrote for the Times Union, and it's about that. It's about our struggle, what's going on with our life. So if almost every place we do, even if it's really like fences, you have to listen to the story. It's about the black family. It plays like Anthony's Behaving. It's fun. It's all the dancing, the singing, everything. It's fun. But if you know the story, the portraying, it's about Fats Waller's music. During that time, 1920, 1930, it's those people were performing for white audience, but the performers themselves, after the show, could not step in the lobby for a drink. They had to sneak them out to get home. And all that, there's a story behind it, and that's why I do this kind of play. It's all about, you know, social injustice and stuff. Kind of thing that I focus on, not hardcore things to keep people away, but things to bring people together.
Are you present for what the reactions of the audience or the conversation started?
Most time we have a talk back after shows. One thing I hear from a lot of people, especially white, audience members, and people come to me and they say, well, thank you for bringing this story here, because I did not know about this. I did not know this was going on. Same thing with black actors. They say the same thing, because nobody teach them that in school. You learn about George Washington, you know, you learn about, you know, all the white people in history, but they don't teach you anything about, you know, famous black people who did a lot of things, you know, but they will not talk about Malcolm X. Yeah, I bring story of people, you know, who has, you know, usually people are very engaged. They have a lot of questions because they need to learn more. The conversation we have, it's really subject that will teach people, that will bring people together, that will make you think. Before next time you go, you see some of the plays we do. Next time you see, you go outside, you see a tall, you know, black man, and you're not threatened by him just because of that. The play and Misbehaving, one of the actors has dread. That's one of the reasons why I cast him, because too often then you hear, okay, that's dirty, or you're doing drugs, or you're a criminal or something. So when somebody come in, a black person come in, or anybody who has dread, you come, you see somebody like him on stage, you say, oh, that's cool, he's on a big stage, he has dread like me, so it's okay. So that's one of the reasons why, you know, I cast him. But many times I have talked back, and people are really, really interested to learn more and to be educated, and I usually try to do that.
Is there any other thoughts you sort of have on the role of your plays and social justice and public conversations?
No, I just want to keep doing what I'm, you know, doing, bringing those kind of stories. I just want people to talk for everybody in this world. You know, I just want people to know that You know, we all are human. We all want to be treated equally. We all want to be out there and want to get home to their family. And I mean, of course, there's crime anywhere. I don't care if you're Italian, white, black, you know, and depending on the community where you are, there may be more crime than other crime, but there's crime all over. It's focused more on black because the color of their skin. They see that, you know, differently. People need to know because we all are human. We just want to be treated the same way you treat everybody else. And that's what we do. That's what I'm doing. That's what I'm going to keep doing, to educate people about that, to educate people about everything's going out there, you know, what you see on television, because it's real and people need to work together. The world better, life better. The only thing I can think of, there's many more, but I can think of a lot of stuff like that. I'm sure I have to keep doing what I'm doing to educate everybody, because I'm about bringing people together.
For more information, go to blacktheatertroupeofupstateny.org. And more segments from Lizzie Kramer and all of today's segments, go to mediasanctuary.org/stories. And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Andrea Cunliffe, and our engineer is Sina Basila Hickey. This program is produced entirely by volunteers. To learn how you can contribute to the local stories of social and environmental justice, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or join our weekly virtual Zoom meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. Thank you to all our volunteers and sanctuary sustainers. If you value independent media, consider a gift of monthly donation as a sanctuary sustainer by going to mediasanctuary.org. Tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news or stream Sanctuary Radio at mediasanctuary.org. You can find all the stories from today's program on our website through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and on our Facebook page at Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.